This is Triad Arts Weekend, where we let you know what's going on in all the arts right here in the Piedmont Triad. Dance, music, visual art, literature, it's all fair game here on Triad Arts Weekend, and we begin with theater today. Back in 1978, American dramatist and actress Beth Henley won a Pulitzer Prize for her play Crimes of the Heart. It was the Mississippi native's first professionally produced play, and since then, Beth's become one of this country's most influential theater voices. That voice is well known for blending the comic and serious in nearly all of her pieces. A wonderful example can be found throughout her play Abundance, which opened earlier this week at Hanesbrands Theater, compliments of Triad Stage. It's being directed by Preston Lane. Abundance was Beth Henley's first play not set in the South. The 25-year narrative takes place in 1860s Wyoming and tells the story of two mail-order brides. The hopelessly romantic Bess and fiercely determined Macon meet while waiting for their husbands to arrive. They become close friends as the years pass and their lives overlap. One husband is the abusive, revolting Mr. Rooker, who's so foul that his nastiness actually provides comic relief. Husband number two is the meeker, glass-eyed Mr. Flaherty, faced with a loveless and bankrupt life. Beth Henley spoke with me by phone from her home in Los Angeles. I've never seen a full production of Abundance. I was just online watching Act 1, Scene 2 from a Rutgers University production of Abundance.
Oh, wow.
This scene, it looks so grim for Bess and her new husband in that scene. She wants to sing and he hates singing, and she wants to read him from the letter and he hates being read to, and then she needs to cry and he hates criers. I felt somewhat claustrophobic just watching that short scene on YouTube, but then she starts saying things like, "Oh, I don't mind, flea and tick infested bedding," and or something like that, and it's hilarious. What are you trying to do in that scene, or what are you leaving the viewer with?
I think you're introducing the characters, and you kind of get that Jack doesn't read, and that makes him angry, and you get that she really was in love with his brother. From the letters, and that she's determined to make this work, no matter how difficult it seems to be.
When you're starting off there, are you already at that point, as the playwright, thinking in terms of pacing and how slowly you or quickly you kind of reveal who these characters are? When does that begin to enter into the equation in terms of writing?
Well, I think it's a little instinctual. I try to write a first draft without really thinking about the technical aspects. I don't really know where I'm going until I write the scene. I mean, I may know what scenes will be written, but I don't know how they'll be written and what may surprise me within the scenes. But then after I have a draft or two, I really go back and look at what information is revealed when, because in a play that's kind of important to keep the audience wondering. Keep things a mystery until it's time for them not to be a mystery, or always keep them a mystery, depending on what it is.
Sure. But in the case of Abundance, once you've had this beginning of an idea of, Western through the perspective of two women, how did the idea of a Western through the perspective of these two women first begin in your mind? Did it flow easily from there?
I think I was reading the Wisconsin Death Trip, and I just became obsessed with the images. It was sort of a West I hadn't seen portrayed. I was back when you didn't have an internet, so it was much harder to do research. But I liked the idea of people, two women going West with their hopes and dreams. And I started just reading a lot of letters and history. I learned a lot about the women who've been captured by the Indians, like Olive Oatman is basically an inspiration for Bess, because she did go on tours after she'd been rescued.
Mm. You combine black humor and the sort of melancholy in some of the scenes that I've watched again in some really interesting ways in this play. I like the almost slapsticky scene where Lanny reveals that, yes, I lost my eye, and she says something to the effect of, "Oh, that thing," or it just hits me, and I'm laughing out loud. But where does that come from? Or I guess, how do you do it so well? I mean, it just works.
Gosh, it's one of those things, I think it's my worldview, and I don't know what's responsible for that. Maybe my family, but it's a feeling that everything is tragic and comic within a breath of each other.
seems like you've got two kindred spirits kind of coming together in these two women. How important is their you know, friendship or relationship in this play?
Well, I think it's the key relationship. I mean, it really is almost their love story, because they have understood things about each other that no one else ever could or maybe would even be interested in. Each of them has seen the innocence of the other, and each of them has seen the dark shadow side of the other. And still at the end, they know each other. They can talk to each other because of that.
Hmm. As the all-knowing playwright in this case, Beth, are you pulling for all the characters, warts and all, or is it a black and white where the husbands are the bad guys and the wives are innocent victims?
Gosh, no, I don't think anyone is innocent in this play.
Hmm.
By a long shot. And I certainly have great adoration for the husbands, because they very much are humans.
Can you reveal some of the vulnerabilities of the, I mean, obviously in the scene that I just referenced there, afraid to confess that he's not a reader, but what are some of the vulnerabilities that these men reflect in the course of the play?
Jack is just driven by such primal instincts. He wants what he wants, but yet he has a deep fear that he's not worthwhile.
Hmm.
I think that's why he's so easily malleable when it's necessary for his security.
American dramatist and actress Beth Henley. Her 1990 play Abundance, set in 1860s Wyoming, is playing at Haynes Brands Theater in Winston-Salem through May 17th. It's a triad stage production directed by Preston Lane, and you'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. This is Triad Arts Weekend. Hey, what's the big deal about The Wire? I mean, it's just TV, right? Well, film scholar Mary Dalton and her students have the answer to my provocative question when we go behind the scenes later on the show. Eddie Garcia will chat with Mary and some of her film studies students about their 600-page answer to what makes The Wire tick. But first, before we get to The Wire, we'll check out some incredible watercolors. She's been honored in Watercolor Artists magazine as one of the ones to watch. Last year, three of her paintings were published in the Artistic Touch, Volume 6, and she kicked off 2015 by having her work accepted by the American Watercolor Society. Their annual spring exhibition just wrapped up last month in New York City, and it's considered by many to be the most prestigious and competitive watercolor exhibition in the country. But you don't have to travel to the big city to catch Alexis Levine's wonderful work. The Greensboro-based artist is a solo exhibition of recent watercolors going on at Hampton House Gallery on Coliseum Drive in Winston-Salem through May 30th. Alexis Levine's use of color and light is truly awe-inspiring, and her skills as an artist allow her to represent her subjects in a variety of styles, from impressionistic images to hyper-realism so detailed you have to give it a double take to make sure it's not a photograph. Whichever technique she's exploring, Alexis's paintings are captivating, personal reflections that will have your eyes glued to the canvas.
When I started college, I decided to major in microbiology. I'd always been interested in science and art, and I guess I felt that majoring in science was more practical. Plus, my father was a scientist, and I think I kind of wanted to follow in his footsteps. Eventually, I realized, however, that I really had the soul of an artist, and I started doing some research. And I discovered that there was a field called medical illustration. And also, I was living in Maryland at the time, going to the University of Maryland, and I discovered that Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore had a master's degree program in medical illustration. And I was able to get accepted, and I went through their program. It was 2 years. And it was a great way for me to combine my love of art and also my interest in science.
The soul of an artist. I like that. I've heard that term before, but how did you make that discovery? What sorts of things led you to believe that?
The soul of an artist. Actually, what did it was The summer in between my junior and senior year in college, I spent in Guadalajara, Mexico. It was one of these study abroad programs. And while I was there, I took some art courses, and they used to bus us to various places in the city and outside of the city. And I sort of delved back into the artistic side of my life, which I had kind of put on hold while I was studying all this science in college. And boy, it really clicked. And I went back to college for my senior year. I decided to finish my degree in microbiology. Being a practical person, I wanted that degree. But I knew that eventually I'd end up doing something artistic.
Eventually, your environment changed and suddenly your focus changes.
Yes. Well, what happened was I had my degree from Hopkins and I was all set to launch my career as a medical illustrator. And then through a variety of family decisions, my husband and I ended up living in Western Maryland in the rural mountains in a very small town called Cumberland. This was actually back in the days, if you can remember, before email and fax machines. And it was really hard at that time to be a medical illustrator if you weren't right in a major city where there was a medical school and a medical publisher.
We should say for listeners, medical illustration is really, really detailed work, isn't it?
Yes, very detailed work. Medical illustrators are basically preparing instructional illustrations for doctors and nurses and health professionals, illustrating anatomy, surgical procedures, all kinds of medical procedures.
Is it mostly done with digital brushes today?
Well, these days it is, yes. Back then it was done with pens and pencils and watercolor. So I did start to learn to paint in watercolor as a young medical illustrator. But then I ended up living in this little town, and it was really hard to continue my career as a medical illustrator. And I looked around me, and it was absolutely gorgeous. The landscape was spectacular. It was in the mountains, which are very similar to the North Carolina mountains. And I started painting. I pulled out my watercolors and I started painting.
What was that like?
It was fantastic. It was everywhere I looked, there was something to inspire me in the landscape or the little townscapes, lots of old Victorian architecture. And it just seemed like the natural thing to do. That was it. I was hooked, and I became a painter, and medical illustration was left behind.
Eventually, you gravitate away from primarily landscape painting into more portraiture. What led to the shift? What was the initial attraction for that change of direction?
About 5 or 6 years ago, I'd been painting landscapes and doing a lot of plein air work for many, many years.
Plein air painting, you're out in the environment painting what you're seeing when there.
Yes. I always felt that as a landscape painter, painting plein air out there immersed in the landscape was really the best way to do it. And so that had been my focus, my primary focus for many, many years. And about 5 years ago, I found myself getting restless and kind of reevaluating my career and my goals. And I felt like I wanted to reach for some bigger goals. I decided that I wanted to try to really, really improve the impact and the design of my paintings and to gain a different kind of recognition for my work. In the watercolor world, there are lots of exhibitions. They're called juried exhibitions, where artists submit work to a juror who is a nationally recognized expert. And that juror puts together a show maybe from 1,000 entries from 1,000 different artists. They'll pull 100 or 150 for an exhibition. So this is what the juried exhibition world is like. And I decided that I wanted to give it a try and see if I could get some recognition and some validation in that way of my work. And in so doing, I decided that I needed to migrate from the plein air world into my little painting studio indoors, primarily because working in the studio, I would have the opportunity to take more time to really fine-tune my designs and craft my drawings and my paintings with fine, fine care.
I want to plumb that a little bit with you. When you say you quoted as saying, I guess on your website, you wanted to bump it up a notch, so to speak. And for the non-painter, maybe you could describe what sorts of techniques or devices you felt you needed to change or improve or refine to in order to do that.
Okay. Here's the thing. If you're painting out on location, you get out there on location, and generally we have about 2 or 3 hours to work. There's so much that's constantly changing out on location. Of course, the sun's always moving, and so shadows, light pattern, light and shadow is always, always changing. And other things can change as well. The weather can change. Things appear and disappear in front of you. And so on location, you really have to get out there, decide what you're going to paint, make up your mind, get right to it, and work fast. And it's great practice because it teaches us to be decisive, to make up our minds, to work with confidence. But on the other hand, there's a certain loose quality to those paintings outdoors. And I felt that to take my work up that notch that you just mentioned, I needed a little more time to really fine-tune it.
One of your colleagues was here not long ago for the big High Point plein air paint out.
Yes.
And he was describing the elusive nature of color values over time and how you need to get it in quick so that you have your color values established within an hour or two, because it's completely different 3 hours later due to the sun.
Mm-hmm. As the sun moves and the shadow patterns change, the quality of the light changes as well. And so colors will start to appear warmer or cooler or lighter or darker. That's where the value comes in. And you really have to nail it pretty quickly.
Mm. So you're in the studio. You've got this luxury of time and
Absolutely.
Precision. And now you're going off of, in this case, photographs in some examples.
Mm-hmm.
Different process entirely.
Yes, it's a very different process. And when I'm in my studio now, I'm usually using photographs. And so that moment, of course, is frozen in time. The color values are not changing. And I have all the time I need to interpret those photos. But I would like to say that working from photos, I feel very strongly that I shouldn't copy them directly. I'd like to use the word interpret.
Hmm. How liberal of an interpretation can that be, Alexis, if someone's sitting on a motorcycle, for example, where those three gentlemen I'm looking at now, and this is the painting At the Crossing, and three gentlemen, I believe they're gentlemen, backs to me, but one turned in profile, waiting for the train to go by. How many liberties were taken from that photograph? I mean, were they in that rough position, for example?
Well, what I will say is that painting was put together with the aid of three photographs, not just one. I had been stopped at a railroad crossing behind these three guys. And initially, I was sitting there in my car, kind of hypnotized by the motion of the trains going by. And suddenly, I kind of snapped into awareness, and I looked out and saw these three guys in front of me and these three fabulous dark shapes, because they're all wearing black jackets, black helmets, black motorcycles, deep shadows. So I grabbed my camera and I started shooting pictures, and I just had time for about four pictures, and then the train was gone and these guys were gone too. And when I got back to my studio, I looked at my pictures. One of the guys in the painting came from one of the photographs where I liked the way he was turned. And one guy looks like he's texting, he's checking his cell phone. He was from another photograph.
Oh.
The last photograph was taken after the train had passed and the arm was starting to go up. And so I could see the arm going up in a bit of the landscape behind across the street. And so I kind of took the best bits from the various photographs and put them all together into one painting.
How about that? You're constructing the image almost with the advantage of hindsight. You say, oh, there was a beautiful building off in the distance. Mm-hmm. I didn't see that because the crosswalk was covering it initially.
Right. And the painting of a couple of chairs at a good friend's house, his friend lives in Maryland, the photograph that I used was taken in the summertime. And so the grass was green and the trees in the background were covered with leaves. And I just felt like painting winter. And so I changed the values, to use that word again, the values and the colors, and tried to imagine what these chairs and the landscape would look like in the middle of January in a snowstorm. And it was great fun to paint it, and it was a great way to interpret that photograph. So I think this is a really good example of how I'll use photographs. They give me an initial idea or an inspiration, and then I just can zoom off in any direction I want in terms of interpreting them.
What all goes into from the sketching and the first selecting your subject? I mean, what's got to grab you to move forward first?
Okay, well, that's a great way of phrasing the question, because something has to grab me. I have literally thousands and thousands of photographs. I wait until something just kind of leaps out and grabs me and says, paint me. The shapes are right, the colors are right, the shadows are right. Before I even pick up a pencil, I give it some thought to just try to envision it a bit more in my mind, and then I start to draw. And the first step is always a small sketch, pencil sketch. I start virtually every painting that way. I make these sketches no bigger than a postcard, sometimes as small as a playing card, and I'm just working with the major important shapes that I see. And I'm thinking at that point also about how dark or light those shapes are going to be and how I need to arrange them within the rectangle of my paper so that they'll have the most impact. These drawings can go through as many as 3 or 4 revisions, each time refining the shapes or maybe moving a figure slightly. And so sometimes I'll even be working on a drawing with multiple figures and I'll cut them up and start moving them around, and then I'll tape them back together, and then I'll draw them again on another fresh piece of paper. And so this can take as much as a couple of days. And once I finally have it all worked out, then what I'll do is transfer the drawing to my watercolor paper so that it's nice and fresh and I don't have lots of erasures and the paper's clean and it's ready to go. With watercolor, the traditional way to paint, because of the transparent nature of the medium, is to start with your lightest colors or values. Value refers to how light or dark something is. To start at the light and work your way darker, 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 darker until the darkest comes in at the end. I find that I have much more success if I either start with the dark or jump to the dark when I'm, let's say, 20 to 30% into the painting. Another thing that I find to be really important is revisiting all of my edges. An edge is where one shape meets up with another shape. And along that edge, there might be a change in color or a change in value from light to dark. And the quality of that edge, is it sharp and hard and precise? Is it soft and kind of easy on the eyes? Is it completely lost with a real gentle transition from one shape to the next? And I find that it's extremely important for me to control those edges so that I have a variety of different kinds of edges in the painting. And also, I want the edges to be different to express different qualities that I'm after.
I'm looking at the painting Steamed or Browned, and two of the iconic, I'm assuming, Chinese food containers opened, and the white lids catching the sun. And there's this very ethereal, beautiful mixture of oranges and golds in the shadow coming toward the right corner of the painting. But then you've delineated so clearly the edges, as you say, that the tops of the containers in such a way, the contrast really brings it alive for me.
Mm-hmm. In all of my paintings, I am utilizing contrasts as effectively as I can. And so in this painting of the Chinese food containers, the lightest lights and the darkest darks and the hardest, sharpest edges are all in one part of the painting. That's what we refer to as the focal area. So that's where I want you, as my viewer, to be drawn to. That's where I want you to look first and longest and last. But I also would like you to be able to wander visually through the rest of the painting. And so I create certain directional cues that will hopefully direct you to meander through the rest of the painting, but still end up at that focal area.
Could that cue be a chopstick by chance?
It could be.
Each of your portraits seems to tell a story in so many ways, and maybe not so much with the Chinese food, although, you know, you wonder who's eating that and what are they doing? Are they watching TV? Did they take a break? At what point does this storytelling become important to you as the painter?
Storytelling is very important to me. I think that pretty much all of my paintings are telling stories. And one thing that I've found that I think it's kind of curious and amusing in a way, that when way back when I was in medical illustration, as illustrators, we were telling stories. Back then, I might have been telling the story of how to perform a new way to remove, a gallstone. but it was a story for doctors or surgeons. But I was trained to be a medical storyteller, a medical visual storyteller back then. And I have found that in the last few years, as my art has taken this new turn, that I've really sort of delved back into storytelling. And more so than when I was a plein air painter, now that I'm in the studio and I have this time to really think about my paintings, I really am more of a storyteller. So in a strange kind of way, I've made a big, huge circle with my art. I started out as a storyteller, and here I am doing it again.
Well, Alexis Levine, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You are so welcome. This was really great.
Watercolor painter Alexis Levine. Her solo exhibition is now on display at Hampton House Gallery on Coliseum Drive in Winston-Salem, where it'll remain through the end of May. You'll find links to her art, Hampton House, and more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Glad to be along with you today for another survey of the fertile artistic ground that is the Piedmont Triad. Hey, speaking of arts, have you been to the new Artivity on the Green recently? Probably not, because the grand opening is just this weekend, but it's on Liberty Street between 6th and 7th Streets in Winston-Salem. The nonprofit Art for Art's Sake developed the idea to bring an art park to the City of Arts and Innovation. They're hoping to tie the Arts District and Innovation Quarter together, and from the pictures I've seen, it looks like they're well on their way. The park has a nice water feature, a gazebo, and places to display local art on a huge mural wall. It's also got a unique-looking tower cloud that's positioned in the middle of the park with an element that creates a cloud of water vapor, sort of harkening back to the city's tobacco heritage. You'll find links to photos at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. We're going to take another short break, and then Eddie Garcia is here with our resident film scholar Mary Dalton, her students, and their combined analysis of the award-winning HBO series, The Wire. Next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues.
Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. In about 10 minutes from now, David Ford returns with composer Tom Hooser. Tom scored the animated short Death in the Robot, one of my favorite animated films from last year. He's got some exciting new projects in the works, so stick around. But first, if you walk through the garden. The HBO series The Wire completed its critically acclaimed broadcast run in 2008. In the years since, interest in the show hasn't waned, and if anything, its significance is even clearer. Widely heralded as either the best or one of the best television series of all time, much has been written on The Wire. If you doubt me, it's just a Google search away. My guest today contributed to a 600-page book of essays on the show, but from a new perspective. The Baltimore-based drama was the subject of Wake Forest University professor Mary Dalton's Critical Media Studies class. She tasked her students with authoring and publishing a book, Critical Media Studies, Student Essays on The Wire. I spoke with Professor Dalton and students Connor McKenzie and Allie Harper. So, Ali, your essay is the lead essay in the book, The America Left Behind, An Exploration of Audience Empathy and The Wire's Baltimore. And it opens with, "The Wire is a smear on this city that will take decades to overcome," is what former police commissioner Frederick H. Beefield III said of the series at a 2011 event. Beefield, who was a police commissioner during the original cable run of the series, expressed his disgust at the contrast between crime shows based in New York, Miami, and Los Angeles, and The Wire. So expand on that and tell me where you're going with this essay and what readers get from this.
There's been a lot of criticism of The Wire from people from Baltimore, that we like to call ourselves Baltimoreans, because they say, like the police commissioner, that Baltimore was shown in a negative light and David Simon's portrayal was not positive. I, in a way, agree with that, but it's shown in a real light. The portrayal of Baltimore is not necessarily negative, just true.
So, Connor, one of your essays is titled Institutional and Personal Reformation, and it begins with, "By the start of season 3 of The Wire, it is no secret to the viewer that Baltimore is a troubled city in need of answers to the abundance of complex issues plaguing it. This season examines the philosophy of reform in the institutions of Baltimore, as well as the personal lives of the city's inhabitants and the expectations they battle." So tell me how you explore the ideas of reformation.
I take the approach that institutional reformation is represented as something that is feeble, can't really happen. The way that the show presents it is that it's usually one individual's going to try to fix the system. So, for example, Bunny Colvin tries to fix the drug problem by legalizing drugs within one specific section of Western Baltimore. It doesn't work. These one individuals can't change these long-standing systems. As idealistic or as hopeful you may be that you're going to change it for the better, The Wire just shows that it's just so difficult to happen.
As a viewer, I mean, that's kind of a bummer, right?
Yeah. I think that the best way to describe The Wire is life's a bummer. Like, it, every season ends with, it goes back to the way it was in the first episode, just about. We see that life just keeps going and that it's not going to stop.
So why does it interest us so much, though?
See, that was what I wanted to find out when I was writing this paper, was that it shows these, like, terrible stories of, like, the institutions, they're not going to get changed. Like, the drug crisis isn't going to get changed. Like, politicians are going to keep doing what they're doing by exploiting everybody else. And so you see these, this, like, really bleak outlook on institutions, but he presents this awesome light that an individual can change themselves. That you have Detective Carver. He starts off in season one as this very childish, he's out there to bang heads, and you see him, he's a bad cop, to put it lightly. And you see him over the course of the season, the series, become this idealistic. He ultimately turns in one of his fellow officers for doing what he used to do, that he has become a good human. And the reason why is because he goes out every day and he sees that what they do actually matters. There is a reason for police to exist. There is a reason for individuals to want to change the drug scene in Western Baltimore. And so individuals have the ability to recognize a problem and reform themselves into a positive light, I think is what The Wire was showing.
So what's in this book for students and for casual readers? Much has been written on The Wire while it was on and since the series has ended. So what are you and your fellow students bringing to the table that hasn't been said before?
I think that our book is different because it takes a character that a viewer is confused about and it nitpicks it down to why that character is that way. And let's say you have a hated character, you read one of our essays and you understand them better. And I think that's really important for The Wire because not everything is nice and neat. Not everything is tied up in a nice pretty bow. You're going to hate probably at least every single character at least one time in the whole series.
I think another thing that our book offers that you don't find in others is that it's written by college students. And so I think that the voice of a college student is very well represented in this text that I don't think you could find anywhere else. Like the three texts that we had, it's an academic that's writing about The Wire. Like you can definitely feel that in some of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think that we, in our essays, have that critical approach, like don't get me wrong, it's still definitely an academic approach, but I think it's more relatable
as opposed to someone in academia or critics, you know.
Yeah,
someone's
critics.
Paid,
yeah.
Critic.
Mm-hmm.
you know, what's the significance of the series and the significance of this book, particularly in light of recent events in Baltimore?
This series is going to get a lot of attention. Positive things about Baltimore have been coming out in the past couple days, but in the past couple weeks, it's been very negative. There's been violent riots, and I think that people are going to kind of turn to The Wire to get some answers. The Wire deals with that part of the city, and no other show does that.
I definitely agree. I mean, you've already seen David Simon, for example, go on to CNN and other news sources to give his opinion. And I think that the importance that The Wire has in light of all these events is that once you watch The Wire and you see this side of life that you've never been exposed to, you can understand where the anger comes from, where the exploitation comes from. It's been around for a long time. The Wire gives you that lens into a part of the city that you've never gone to, that you've never understood. It shows you that these are people and that it is a difficult area to live in. And it's very oppressed. It's great poverty. And people feel like they've been forgotten. I think there's a quote when somebody dies and they don't have it on the front page of the newspaper. And the little jib is that, oh, he died in the wrong zip code. There's always this constant source in The Wire that this is the forgotten side of the city that we don't want to look at. And so I think The Wire will become important now, and that it can show you that side of the city that you've never seen.
Well, Allie and Connor, congratulations on the book, and thanks for coming in today.
Thank you for having us.
When you walk through the garden, you gotta watch your back.
So, Mary, how did you first come across The Wire?
You know, I heard about it from a student. I was starting to work on a book, Teacher TV, 60 Years of Teachers on Television, and one of my students said, you have to see season 4 of The Wire. And he persisted and persisted, and of course he was absolutely right. Season 4 is my favorite because I was working on that project, and I ended up writing, I co-authored that book, but I did the final chapter, and I focused the whole chapter on this season of The Wire because it's really profound in the way it talks about education policy.
Nothing had been done on television like that before.
Or since.
Okay, so why have students write and publish a book?
At first, I was just going to teach a seminar on The Wire. And then, I don't know, Eddie, somehow over the Christmas break, I just had this idea. And I just thought, I edit volumes. I think students are smart. I think student voices are underrepresented out in the marketplace of ideas. And let's just see if this works. It was just a bold experiment.
Beyond the content, what do they learn about what it takes to publish a book and the book craft?
Well, you know, my thought about Wake Forest students is that if you set the bar high, they're going to work really hard to reach that. And so I thought by thinking about it as a publication that would go out into the world, that it would motivate them in a different way. It would be a win-win. It would motivate them to do their very best work. It would also put their voices out in that marketplace of ideas. I tried a lot of new things in this class, and one of them was to have them work in research teams and do peer editing and to do presentations of texts that weren't covered in the class and then share that with people they thought would be, they would find it useful for their own writing. And then beyond that, though, you know, they had to learn about bibliographies in a way that they hadn't thought about them before and why they're useful, and indexing, because, you know, I really have treated this project the same way I would a scholarly anthology that I'm putting forward for an academic press. I wanted them to meet as many of those benchmarks and standards as they could. And we learned about copyright and fair use and how to take images that are legal, you know, to take screen captures, to do that in a legal way for the book. And the cover, the front back cover, is designed by one of the students in the class. But we sat in class and looked at her ideas, and then students contributed, you know, some suggestions that I think even improved it. Her work was wonderful, but, you know, as a group, we approved it. We talked in class about what we wanted the typeface to look like. And, you know, we approached all those decisions. And then recently when we, you know, figured out how long the book was going to be, I hate to scare people, but, you know, we're talking about a 600-page book here.
But you can dip in and out.
You can dip in and out. I mean, yes, absolutely, because each piece is a standalone. But when we started looking at that and figuring out the sort of mechanics of the publication, we sat in class and discussed what the Amazon price for the book is going to be and made decisions about that. We're not going to make very much money. We might not make any money, but if we make a little bit of money, it's all going to benefit the film studies program at Wake Forest.
Excellent. So let's put your media studies cap back on. Just want to kind of get your opinion on something. It's a rare show, I think, that can be important, you know, topical, but also be able to work as pure entertainment. Mm-hmm. And that's like Connor said, too, the first time you went through, you're more kind of taking it all in and be like, this is a well-crafted and it's an exciting show. Why are those so often exclusive, and how did The Wire fuse those approaches?
Well, one of the things we talked about a lot in class is how this show would never have existed without a subscription service like HBO, because it is producer, creator, writer driven. And they're able to take chances and do things that are so completely different from the police procedurals that wrap up cases within a particular episode. So I think it's really important for us to think about context and why it exists there. I think the reason that you don't see more of this type of work, well, A, it takes a brilliant team to be able to pull it off, but B, you know, you're not going to have a huge audience. And that's what broadcast or other types of cable are not going to produce, because they're looking for the number of viewers. And in the case of The Wire, it was a slow build. It's still relevant now, you know, a decade plus after it went on the air, it's still relevant. It's as relevant or more relevant than ever. But TV that is short-term profit-driven, looking for those ratings and looking for sponsor support, you're not going to see them take those chances.
So if someone out there hasn't seen The Wire yet or feel that perhaps it's a bit hyped, or some people are like, oh, it's another crime procedural, what do you say to them to get them to check it out?
It's a remarkable show. There's nothing like it. And the reason is, as the students have articulated, I mean, the reason is that it works on so many different levels. You are engaged in the characters and the personal stories, but I have never seen such a sophisticated critique of institutions and systems.
You'll save your soul. You gotta keep the devil.
Professor of Communication, Film Studies, and Women's and Gender Studies at Wake Forest University, Mary Dalton. Earlier, we heard from her students Connor McKenzie and Ali Harper. They're two of the many authors of Critical Media Studies, Student Essays on The Wire. It's available now on Amazon.com in physical and digital versions. And you'll find a link at WFDD.org and click on Try It Arts Weekend.
That's technical producer Eddie Garcia. I'm David Ford. This is Try It Arts Weekend, and we're going to jump from the flickies to film scoring now. Composer-producer Tom Hooser received his BM in sound recording technology from Ithaca College before earning an MFA in film scoring at UNC School of the Arts in Winston-Salem. He since returned to Winston, where he's found the perfect marriage of both in surround sound composing techniques. He's employed them in the recently premiered indie film Bruconomy and in his current sound engineering project, Saturn's Rings, due out next year.
I think just taking a really great piece of music and just figuring out, just deciding like, hey, some of these people are going to be in the rear channels. The music for Bruconomy, I specifically mixed in surround sound for the premiere, was in an IMAX theater in Raleigh, the Marbles IMAX theater in Raleigh. And so I made it a bit subtle, but I did put some little accompanying parts I put in the rear channels, just to have, like, you know, for the ending of the movie, oh, we hear a little guitar chord in the back behind us, and it just kind of gives just a little bit of like boost and energy to the experience, because like, oh, that's really clear and I hear it, I'm in the ensemble rather than just like things coming at me. Brewconomy is an independent documentary that focuses on the North Carolina craft brewing industry. It focuses on the impact on farmers, the greater demand for their products for the growth of wheat and hops to provide the ingredients for craft beer. It focuses on the jobs that are created in breweries, in brew pubs, in distributors, in bottle shops, and it focuses on how craft brewing positively affects communities where there are small batch breweries, craft breweries in the community.
You've got another film in process, Saturn's Rings. Talk about a juxtaposition, quite different from local breweries.
Saturn's Rings is an amazing project. It's the brainchild of Stephen Van Vuren, a independent filmmaker in Greensboro. And this film is unlike any film that's ever been made before. It utilizes real photographs from space, images from the Cassini space probe orbiting Saturn. Stephen came up with the idea to take those photographs and essentially use each one as a frame of video. And what we have now is video sequences of space created with multi-plane animation. They essentially take the raw sensor data off of multiple cameras in space, on space probes, on satellites, and so on, and take the image, the raw data, process it into an actual image, and then take three of those frames and stitch them together to make a full frame for IMAX. And so this was an IMAX movie being produced before IMAX was cool. It's been in the process for over 7 years. Stephen processes all these images in his home. He has a server of 19 computers processing data constantly to create these beautiful high-resolution video sequences. Portion of the film that I'm working on is the climax of the movie where we actually make it to Saturn. And when we make it to Saturn, we see images of Saturn's rings up close, and we hear Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings. Stephen wanted to produce a high-quality recording because past recordings, such as the very famous recording with Leonard Bernstein, are played beautifully, but the audio quality is a bit low. And so he raised money on Kickstarter to do a high-quality recording with the Greensboro Symphony Orchestra in Mamandi Concert Hall. And my role on the project has been to function as music editor for the climax of the movie with the recording of Barber's Adagio for Strings. And so mixing, doing basic surround mixes, cutting takes together, taking out noises, taking the raw recordings and turning it into the experience that we want to have in the theater. And it's really coming together, and I have the most current version I'll be able to share with y'all.
Great. So this is Barber's Adagio for Strings, Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings, the orchestrated version that Toscanini requested, and it's being performed by the Greensboro Symphony?
That's correct.
Is Dmitri Sitkovetsky conducting?
Yes.
Well, how about that? Great. Well, that's going local in a big way. On a great piece of music, and it pairs so nicely with that image. I mean, I'm seeing my little computer screen, obviously, the images of Saturn and in various angles, and yet that piece of music has been used time and time again. But it's so powerful, you can't deny it.
Yes, and it has such a unique form and phrase structure. The repetition of the theme, and then our climax in the piece. I don't think there's any piece that quite matches that musical structure. It's very different. I don't think we'd learn about all kinds of standard musical structures in school, and there's many pieces that follow it, such as sonata form, and Barber's Adagio for Strings is really different.
Winston-Salem-based film score composer Tom Hooser. His movie Death and the Robot can be seen on Vimeo, and you'll find links to Bruconomy and images from Saturn's rings on our website, WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, that's all for today's show. Triad Arts Weekend takes a village, folks, and that village, for the past 4 months, has included an amazing Wake Forest University senior English major, Elena Dolman. Friday is her last day working with the Triad Arts team, and boy, are we going to miss her. While interning at WFDD, Elena has conducted wonderful local interviews, written engaging stories for the web, and enhanced them with her own photos. We know there's lots more where that came from, and we wish you the very best as you head off into the real, unreal world out there, Elena Dolman. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia, and our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. You can follow us on Twitter at Triad Arts Speak, and you'll find podcasts and archived episodes at WFDD.org. Just click on Triad Arts Weekend. And if you've got questions, comments, or suggestions for this show, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at triadarts@wfu.edu. In the meantime, I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.